welcome to Worlds Apart. Just a few years ago, the threat of religious, specifically Islamic fundamentalism, was deemed by many countries as one of the top security threats, providing a pretext for ballooning defense budgets and fueling the US-led war on terror. But following the COVID-19 pandemic and especially the clash between Russia and the West in and over Ukraine, one hardly hears about it anymore. Is it no longer an issue? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hussein Solomon, senior professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of the Free State in South Africa. Professor Solomon, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for finding the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, I heard you say in an interview last year that in a couple of years, we will no longer hear about Islamic fundamentalism. And it seems that your forecast has realized ahead of schedule, because one can barely see this issue mentioned, even in professional publications, let alone the mass media. How is it possible that it became such a non-issue after being such a huge issue only a couple of years ago?
Well, I would maybe say that I'm not so categorically that it's the end. I think it comes in waves, and I think that one form of fundamentalism feeds another. And I think that what essentially happened was when they did come to power, for example, in Egypt, if you take the Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have a disastrous year in power, for various reasons, but in my view, any religion is not a template for governance. I myself am a practicing Muslim and I read my Quran every night, but it's not a textbook in terms of how to govern a country or how to economically kickstart a country. And I think the numerous failures have resulted in ordinary people having a relook and a re-examination. But by no means is it over, right? We have just seen, for example, where the Americans have cut a deal with the Taliban in terms of Doha. And the Taliban come to power, and if they try to moderate their stance, then you have the Islamic State, Khorasan, coming in and occupying those positions that they have traditionally done so. So I think it comes in ebbs and waves, but I also think that the contradictions in terms of Islamism, as well as the failures in government, has basically resulted in them not being as attractive as before.
I remember when this issue was still a fashionable topic, there was a lot of discussion about the separation of the state and religion and whether it's possible in the Muslim countries. Was it really about Islam or any ontological underpinnings as opposed to simply politics? Because if we look at how fluid this issue, how quickly it disappeared from public awareness or public concern, it seems that it was to a large extent, that discussion to a large extent was driven by politics, and not just politics, but politics of the day, the manipulations of the day, I would say.
No, absolutely. Look, many of these individuals, in my view, make use of Islam, the faith, as a political vehicle, as a form of mobilization. I myself am all in favor of a secular state, because I think that and it's something which came out of the 2009 uprisings in terms of Iran, where Iranian clerics were actually questioning the proximity between faith and state, believing that the faith itself becomes tarnished by its politicization, because in a sense, all politics is dirty, okay? And I think that there is, in the Muslim world, an attempt by people, not to do it in a Western style, but to actually look at the Quran and so forth, re-look at it, and actually ask if you can actually have the separation of powers. And what I find very interesting is, for example, when I went to madrasa, right, to your equivalent of Sunday school, I was just taught Sharia, but with Sharia being Islamic law, but not understanding that it's far more complex than that. So, for example, you have siyasa, okay, and fiqh. Fiqh is personal morality, right? I'm not going to touch alcohol, would fall under that. But siyasa is about the public good. And the role of the state is fundamentally to promote siyasa, the public good. The interesting thing about public good is that it's not defined by the Quran, okay? It's not scriptures there. So, for example, whether you are Christian...
Can I stop you here? Because I think any religion comes not only with personal beliefs, but a certain view of the world, certain definitions of good and bad, including what's good and bad for the collective, for the society. So is it really possible to fully separate those things? Because if you are a practicing, authentically practicing a Muslim or Christian, you have a certain notion of what your society is supposed to be. And sure, you can influence that through indirect means, through voting, through your volunteering work, but it will still have some influence on the shape of the state that you live in. Or am I wrong here?
Look, Muslims are a very tiny minority in South Africa, okay? At the mosque where I worship, right next to my mosque, there's a bottle store and a pub, okay? Now, it's up to me, right, in terms of my personal morality, in terms of my personal religious beliefs, to walk into the mosque as opposed to the pub and to have an alcoholic drink, okay? I have friends of mine who do frequent the pub. I enter the pub and I'll have a Coke. It's not the role of the state, in my view, to dictate personal morality, because fundamentally then you're getting into the relationship and how you define that relationship between your personal beliefs and God. So I think that the state needs to stay away from that. Of course, there are certain things in terms of the public good which needs to be regulated and so forth, but there should be broad consensus around those issues, right? So for example, there's the widespread existence of pornography, but you can say that collectively we as a society is totally opposed to child pornography.
Now, going back to the use of religion in politics, I heard you say before that one cannot understand the emergence of Boko Haram in Nigeria without understanding Kanuri nationalism, or one cannot understand the Taliban without looking deeply into the Pashtun nationalism. I wonder how significant are the differences between those various forces and how they seek to mobilize and utilize Islam. Do they borrow from each other? Do they use the same tactics, or they tend to be more or less grassroots?
I've been studying political Islam since 1998, and I can tell you that there's no overarching command and control and so on. Even where you have a faction of Boko Haram becoming part of Islamic State and so on, they tend to be driven by local dynamics and local grievances, right? So, for example, if you take Nigeria, 27% of the population is living in poverty in the south, but in the Muslim north, it's 72%, okay? And then when you add to that socioeconomic divide, identity politics, where you have a Kanuri nationalism seeking to revive the pre-colonial Kanuri Empire, because they as an ethnic group feel aggrieved. The same dynamic is happening with Al-Shabaab in terms of Somalia, where 70% of the fighters for Al-Shabaab come from one clan, the Rahanweyn clan, and that is because of feelings of political exclusion. In terms of northern Mali, the issue of Tuaregs and the search for an independent Azawad homeland, which dates back at least 500 years. All of these kind of dynamics fuel it. And instead of focusing just issues on counterinsurgency and better intelligence and so on, in my view, it's about addressing those grievances, and it's about good governance, effective governance, and so on.
Can I also ask you one thing as a practicing Muslim? Because Muslims like to think about themselves as one people, as the Ummah, despite the fact that, as you said, there is a huge diversity and dynamism, I think, within Islam and how they interpret the religion and how they practice it. How do you see Islam, if there's even such a unified concept as Islam in this era of globalized communications? And is the concept of Ummah still realistic? Is it something that the Muslims can aspire to, as opposed to, you know, be nostalgic about?
Yeah, sadly, as a Muslim, while I find it appealing, my heart finds it appealing, my mind tells me it's not realizable. I mean, go back to the fact that three of the four caliphs, you know, the first four caliphs were killed. You know, I mean, it was right there, those divisions right at the outset. I mean, if you take the current situation in terms of Yemen, you know, where Muslims are killing Muslims, you know, it's Shia versus Sunni, it is this, it's that. And all of these dynamics, I mean, in all practical purposes, the Ummah is dead, sadly so.
Well, Professor Solomon, we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back to this discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Hussein Solomon, Senior Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of the Free State in South Africa. Professor Solomon, before the break, we were unfortunately discussing the end of the concept of Ummah, and I also heard you say that you believe that Muslim countries are becoming more secular, increasingly more secular, even though if we look at the statistics, Islam is still the world's fastest growing religion. And you know, many of those countries have fairly young populations there. They have fairly large birth rates. What makes you believe that predominantly Muslim countries are becoming more secularized? And what do you mean actually by secularization?
Yeah, well, you are fundamentally talking about what has been termed called the twin tolerations, right? First of all, there was an interesting study basically pointing out that there's no country which is in the world which is fully secular, okay? So for example, if you take the Queen of England, you know, she's the head of the church, right, of England and so forth. And I mean, you see the same in terms of American politics, right, where you have a Christian right playing a more political role and so forth. But increasingly, when you look at surveys being conducted in terms of the world value surveys, if you look at the BBC Arabic, the Arab Barometer, and so forth, they all show more and more people in the Muslim world questioning the prominent role in terms of the clergy, in terms of Islamic norms as determined by the state. So when you talk about religiously minded people, there's your more orthodox interpretation of religion and your more modernist interpretation of religion. More and more young people, what you see, more and more women not wanting to cover their heads. In Algeria, you find more and more people not wishing to fast during Ramadan.
Are we talking about people abandoning their belief systems altogether, or rather perhaps the decline of the political role of those religious dogmas?
What you are seeing is a decline of the political role, the decline of the Islamism, Okay. And you see it in terms of various political parties trying to reinvent themselves. So if you take Tunisia as an example, right, they came out of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ennahda. Okay. And then you have Rashid Ghannouchi, the leader of it, trying to reinvent themselves and saying, just like you have the Christian Democratic Union in Germany, we see ourselves as that kind of political party. But there's also other moves. You know, there is the rise of civil Islam, where you don't involve yourself in politics, but you involve yourself in terms of charity and so on. And there's post-Islamism, which basically started off in the 1990s in Egypt with the Al-Wasat Party as an alternative to the Muslim Brotherhood to basically look for an inclusive religiosity.
You know, I'm a big fan of Swiss psychologist Carl Jung, who discovered the collective unconscious, which, you know, a sort of a phenomenon that is usually referred in traditional religions as God. And I think this is something that is now considered to be an objective fact. I know that there are departments studying this phenomenon in Harvard and the Columbia University. And Jung himself wrote a lot about the interplay between religions and the collective psyche, and the role of religions, the important role of religions that they served in, you know, providing the sense of numinous, the sense of purpose, the sense of meaning for the people. And he actually argued that, you know, for any creed to stay alive, the gods, however they are defined, whichever names they are given, they have to stay alive. People have to sort of relate to them authentically. And if we look at the data for Islam and the spread of Islam, it's clear that it's more vital, more vibrant than many of the other, let's say, Christian denominations. What do you think provides for this sustainability of Islam as a creed, as a sort of a school of thought or as a school of beliefs?
You know, as personally, as a young person growing up, I grew up in a Muslim household, but at the same time, I was in contact with Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and so on. And I sort of experimented with all of these different faiths. And it was only in my early 30s when I sort of returned to Islam, if I can put it to you that way. But I think that one of the reasons driving the growth of Islam is the failure of secular politics, right? And people assume that if you vote for somebody who is waving the crescent or who's speaking in religious term, that the person will be less corrupt, that the person understand that he has a responsibility or she has a responsibility to actually lift up the community and so forth. So I think that what's driving the growth of Islam in many cases is the failure of secular politics in across the Muslim world to actually make good their promises and so forth. And at the same time, the disenchantment of Islamism is when they behave in the same corrupt manner as their secular predecessors.
Now, I also heard you make two very interesting points. One is that there is a need to move away from the Western-centric understanding of democracy as an ideal governance for everybody, including the predominantly Muslim countries. And the second one is the need within the Muslim societies to evolve into more authentic way, into more inclusive, perhaps more democratic way of governance. So let's take them one by one, starting with the Western model as an ideal for all. Why is it not appealing to you?
Look, I think that the Western model, you know, when you look at it, when you look at US elections in particular, if you look at the billions spent, if you look at the kind of catchphrases, make America great again. Oh, make America great. What does it mean? What does it mean in practice? And I think that often democracy like that appeals to the lowest common denominator. Here in my own country, we have a number of political parties which are preparing for the 2024 elections. And it's about, attacks on foreigners. So you have a rise of xenophobic violence and so on. Or in terms of Trump's America, let's blame the Mexicans for all of our problems.
Or
And I
the
think
Biden
that's
administration blaming the Chinese and the Russians for their problems.
And I think that there is a need to have, so I understand what's appealing in terms of Islam is to have a virtuous leader. I'm not sure how you choose that particular leader. How do you know beforehand that the person is committed to, let's say, the social contract? How do you choose the people around that leader who are competent enough to deliver? When the Muslim Brotherhood was running Egypt for that year, I mean, they chose people because they were ostensibly pious. They did their five prayers a day, but that doesn't necessarily make an excellent engineer,
Yeah,
you
being
know.
a good Muslim doesn't make you a good administrator.
Absolutely, absolutely, and so. And that's one of the reasons that I've been pushing, certainly for the secularization of our faith and the separation between mosque and the state and so on. But I also think that there is a need in the Muslim world that when you talk about democracy, it's not Western style democracy and so forth. Because of the spread of Islam that you correctly pointed out earlier on, it has to be authentic and has to reflect the traditions and the cultures of the people. And the other thing is, very importantly, just in passing, I would say this, it is imperative not to enforce it. Because if you
To allow it
enforce
to
it,
develop.
you allow it to develop authentically and so on. And one of the issues which I've been working on quite a bit, if you go back to the rise of liberal democracy, it wouldn't have been possible without an industrial revolution, right? Because you needed a middle class with those kind of values. And the problem in terms of much of the Muslim world, I mean, it is poor in relation to the population size. So the key to realize these liberal values, and when I talk about liberal values, I'm talking about issues of tolerance and acceptance of inclusivity and plurality and dissidence. I think what you need is to have this economic revolution which empowers the poorest of the poor so that they can also share in this vision. I think that when you have a huge gap between rich and poor, it drives fundamentalism.
Can I also ask you about the efforts on the part of predominantly Muslim states to reform themselves? And I would love, for example, to focus on the Gulf states, which I think luckily for them happened to be US allies at the time when the need to change social contract came, because they were allowed a certain pace, certain time to do that. Unlike, let's say, Libya or Syria, which I would claim were sort of ambushed by the West at a very vulnerable social time for themselves. How do you see those efforts? You are far away from both, let's say, the Gulf states and Iran, which also, I think you would agree, needs to be attentive to the social and religious dynamics or undercurrents within its society. How do you think they are dealing with it?
So I'm in South Africa, but I'm not that far from the Gulf states because the Gulf states have been exercising influence, so through their charities, through the mosques and the sermons and so on, coming from Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, and so on, across here. And I think that first of all, if you take the Gulf states, you are talking about very few citizens in some of these states, right? With much of the population being expatriate. I think that the I think when the price of oil was down, there was a much more tensions in the society, okay? But as it has gone up now, I think the rulers make use of oil well to buy off dissent. On the one hand, there is attempts to transform the society, but to be honest with you, it is, I'm not sure how successful they are, and I'm not sure how far they are going to go. So you can't, for example, have a situation where you now show yourself to be progressive by allowing women to drive. But then you take a dissident like Jamal Khashoggi and you saw him into pieces in an Istanbul concert, right? And these are the contradictions. In my view, unless you have that inclusivity and not family-run polities and economies and so on, for there to be a chance of an authentic Islam, and I know what I'm going to say is very controversial, but I think many of the Gulf states, the leadership, have to commit political suicide. In other words, the families, the ruling families, have to step back. And I mean, Islam doesn't allow
To some extent, they have
for.
to choose between their own religion and their own family, and this is an interesting choice for.
Yeah, and of course it's but the family doesn't. It's not just the family. It's about political privilege. It's about economic wealth and so on. And will they do so? I don't think so. And at the moment, they are buying off dissent, and they are running a repressive state, but at the same time, supposedly have openness because you can watch Netflix and stuff like that. And but I
Isn't
don't
that
think it's
also a
deep
way of
enough.
sort of Americanizing their politics, giving people some flashy things to be paraded, but at the root of it, leaving them still in a disempowered state and dependent on the powers that be?
I agree, it's an absolute desert mirage, and I don't think it's sustainable. And you would recall that when people were still focusing on alternative energy sources and so on, and when the oil price was down, the contradictions in their society just escalated, right? But I think that it's sort of settling down, but I don't think it's permanent. And I think they are facing particular crises also on the environmental front. And you also have people who have been educated and so on, and who are now challenging that. You know, you have a middle class emerging, which is not necessarily linked to the state or to family dynasties. And who are finding it hard to necessarily open up the process. But it's not just the Gulf states. I mean, if you look at the power of the military, you know, for example, in countries like Sudan and in Egypt, and the possibilities of actually opening up that economy, that also that civil military relations also needs to be challenged. But now there's a fine line as well. Because it's not so easy for me as an academic in South Africa saying this, because the other aspect of the fine line is, do you want chaos to erupt? So how do you manage that change?
But Professor Solomon, it's always difficult. It's been difficult perennially, and that what distinguishes a great leader ultimately is the ability to, manage those difficulties and conflicting priorities in real time, rather than relying on money to buy that time. Anyway, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time with us today. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.